Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 201.
On today's show, we talk about looting and its repercussions.
Let's dig a little deeper, but not into this show because it's had a rocky, rocky history. All right, everybody, welcome to the Archaeology Show. Rachel, how's it going?
Great. We're traveling. It's been so long.
I know. So this is going to be a little bit, we always mention where we're at because I feel like our listeners, I'm just projecting this onto them,
that they enjoy that they knowing care, these things. That they follow along with us.
But nobody's currently sitting here writing an Apple podcast review that's angry that says, get to the archaeology.
Stop talking about random crap in your lives. We don't care about it.
So today, as we're traveling across the country, and we had to delay a little bit for some upgrade issues and some maintenance issues, and because of that, we are currently driving across the country, so we're trying to record, and we're going to do a segment at each one of our, like, bigger stops. We're going to do a stop right now. We're at the Tennessee Welcome Center.
Yeah.
Just coming on from Mississippi into Tennessee, for anybody that wants to look that up and see what we're doing. We're basically headed to I-40, and then we'll be on that for 1,500 miles.
Yes, because we're trying to get to in between Flagstaff and Phoenix, basically, we're going to be eventually near Sedona.
We'll be near Sedona. Yeah. Basically, once you get on 40, it's like go straight for 1,000 miles.
Just like
and then
stay
turn left
on this interstate.
Yeah.
Well, until you hit a city, because usually you loop around those. But mostly just stay on 40.
Right. Yeah. Right. So anyway, we are going to have an interesting show today. We've got themed, I don't want to say news articles. I guess they're news articles, but themed articles. And right now I will let Rachel steal the show.
Oh, so bad.
I was trying to figure out how to fit that in because I thought about it.
You should have said loot the show.
But that just doesn't,
it doesn't
fit.
Work. I know. Yeah. No, that was good. That was really good. I almost didn't get it for a second. I had to think, what does he mean by steal? But what we're talking about today is effectively stealing artifacts because, and we've talked about this before, sometimes topics just sort of cluster in the news cycle for some reason. And recently there has been a bunch of articles, probably in the last month and a half-ish, of just different stories about different lenses into the looting world of artifacts.
Yeah, this one, first one we're going to talk about is from the Washington Post. And listen, quick little hack for you guys out there. So the Washington Post, if you're not a subscriber, subscribe to the Washington Post if you like what they have. But sometimes they get real annoying if you just want to see one thing.
You just want to read the story real quick.
And I understand it's somebody's work. They need to be paid for it. But sometimes
think with the Washington Post, it's even a free account. But I don't want to go through the trouble of making a free account, blah, blah, blah. So
anyway, if you're on an Apple device, I don't know how this works on Android, but go up into your URL and put it in reader mode.
Mm-hmm.
And it will basically, reader mode basically takes away all the ads and stuff around the edge and coincidentally takes away their sign-in page.
Yes.
So you basically just get the pictures in the article. It doesn't work on every website.
It doesn't. New York Times, because I think New York Times wants you to pay for their content, it doesn't work.
Yeah, you can block it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
anyway, but for this article, that's a great little workaround to not have to make an account to read the article.
Well, it's a good workaround for anybody using an Apple device, especially on a phone or a tablet where you've got limited real estate. Just put it in reader mode and you can just get rid of all that stuff.
Get rid of all the ads and all the other nonsense. Yeah.
Anyway, this article is called Oscar White Muscarella, archaeologist who exposed looted artifacts and fakes, dies at 91. And this was written by Michael S. Rosenwald, again for the Washington Post, on December 29th, 2022.
Yeah, and they were featuring Dr. Muscarella because he was kind of a pioneer in really examining the provenance of artifacts at the Met, where he worked. And provenance is basically the
chain of custody.
The chain of custody for an artifact. So you know that it came from a legitimate source rather than from a looter or a shady dealer or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know how they call it when it's, you know the history from it sitting in your hand or you're looking at it or something like that to when it was either created and or found. But for the demonstration purpose, I'll just call that 100% provenance, right? Like, we know everything about it. So I'm looking at it at, say, a museum like the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, and they know where they bought it. That person knows where they got it. That person knows where they got it. That person knows where they got it. And they got it from a willed family member, and the family member had a cousin who made it.
Yeah.
Or found it in Egypt when they looted it.
Maybe. Yeah. Like, there's a point where it'll get to, it probably will get back to looting at some point, but there, I think there's a point where when it's as far enough in the past where it's not breaking a law or a rule or something like that. That's not necessarily true, but there are ways for it to have good provenance, basically, even for very, very old artifacts.
Right.
So in this case, Dr. Oscar White Mascarella started working for the Met in 1964. And it was a really, really hard time because there were some shady practices in the world of acquiring artifacts, even for a place like the Met, even for a museum as big and as amazing as the Met. And occasionally, artifacts with questionable provenance were bought from disreputable dealers.
Yeah.
It happened, even at the Met. So, I mean, I think it was just like sometimes curators would just get so focused on creating the exhibit they wanted to create and they would kind of turn a blind eye to some things or I'm not really sure how it would get to that point. Because even in the 60s and 70s, like, stolen artifacts were not okay.
No. But in the early to middle parts of the 20th century, I mean, these museums and the people who were, you know, the gentleman scholars who were the ones going out to these sites that had the money that just wanted to go out and do something because they were bored and had the money to do it. Before, there were like, you know, there were real archaeologists, obviously, in the early 20th century, the early 1900s, but there wasn't that many.
Yeah. Right?
There wasn't that many scholars of archaeology. Let's see, there was Indiana Jones, and then there was the Nazis. But aside from them, you know, nobody was really doing this.
Strike everything you just said from the record, please. That is not accurate.
I know. So anyway, so there wasn't a lot of people doing this, and archaeology itself started out with people, again, the gentleman scholar kind of person that would go out and say, you know, I want to go dig in Egypt because I can, I'm interested in it. And then they would take all their finds, you know, to them, it's like, I can leave all this stuff here to the quote unquote savages. And, you know, that's what they would think about them as. They weren't high British society.
Yeah.
So they'd bring them back to the British Museum. They'd bring them back to New York, to the Met, to the two other museums, not just the Met, but to museums worldwide.
Yeah.
As long as it wasn't where it was found, that's where all the cool stuff was.
Yeah.
And we wanted to take it back so they can have this prestige. And that's just what was happening. And it was, again, sometimes it's not questionable that it was looted, like they just didn't call it that.
Yeah.
We call it that now.
Well, it was looting, though. It was just that
it was definitely looting. People, they just didn't think it was.
They didn't care because the culture that the artifacts were taken from just wasn't, their viewpoint wasn't taken into consideration in
those
times.
But people use that argument now, right?
Yeah.
Like, you see, you get on these artifact hunter, and as soon as they put hunter in the word, you get on these artifact hunter Facebook groups and websites where people are just going around on what they say is private land every single time, which is legal in the United States. But I question whether or not it's always private land. But let's just leave it at that. But they go out there and you look at their little videos and stuff, and they're just crunching out some dirt in order to get these projectile points without looking at the provenience, which is different from provenance, which provenience is how is it situated in where it's located right now. But they don't care about that. They don't care anything around it. They just want to take it. And they do that because they say two things. One, archaeologists steal artifacts and put them in museums and boxes where we can't see them. And two, I will get much more enjoyment out of this with my friends and family if I put it up on my mantle, or I sell it and my bank account gets more enjoyment out of it.
Yeah.
So
it's just like it's an archaeology of things rather than people and cultures. And I think that, like, for the last 20, 30, 40 years, archaeologists and anthropologists and other experts have been really working to change that idea and that philosophy, and it's been a slow process.
Yeah.
But Dr. Muscarella was definitely one of the first in the museum world to start pushing back, and he got like really publicly critical of the Met in 1973 when they bought a 2,500-year-old Greek vase for $1 million. Mm-hmm. Now, you might not think that's too crazy, but the dealer that they bought it from is a guy who was named Robert E. Hecht Jr. He's a controversial dealer who was later indicted in Italy on looting charges.
Wow.
However, the statute of limitations ran out before they could actually like go through the trial process.
Yeah.
So that name might sound familiar to you, and that is because we've actually talked about that guy before, Robert Hecht Jr., on an episode of TS, episode 165, because looting always grabs my attention, and yours too, I think, but yeah. When we're looking at articles in the news, because I just love to see like justice done and artifacts being returned to the cultures that they were taken from and the countries and the people. So it always grabs my attention. And we actually did talk about this guy. There was some other repatriated artifacts that he was involved in the deal that happened back in the 90s or 80s or whenever it was. So we'll link to that episode in the show notes if you want to go hear more about the shady things that he was accused of being involved in.
Yeah, I've been interested in looting for a long time, and it was probably, God, 10 plus years ago now that I wrote a blog post called An Open Letter to Arrowhead Hunters.
And oh my God, that's right. I forgot about that.
It's still, I just got a comment on it a month ago.
Did you really?
It still gets comments.
Yeah.
And it's mostly people who are like, you're stupid. Get out of here.
Yeah. I can have whatever I want.
Yeah.
Who cares who originally made it and who, what people it belongs to? Blah, blah, blah.
We'll link to that in the show notes too, well, so you can go leave your own angry comment.
or maybe share it to all the people you know who have artifact collections on their mantles.
Right. But keep in mind, I did write it like 12 years ago.
Oh,
so
yeah,
I don't even
true.
Know what it says yet. I'm sure it's all still very valid.
So you'll link to it if you are still okay with the content.
Yeah, I'll check it out first. then we'll link to it.
Anyway, so this vase that Dr. Muscarella was involved in, or that he was suspicious of, was appraised by other museums at only being worth $500,000, even though they paid $1 million for it.
Mm-hmm.
And he pointed that out to the Met officials, but the officials at the time that he was talking with, I'm trying to be very careful not to like accuse the current Met of doing anything wrong, because I think that there's a lot of people there who are very conscious of this and these problems, and they are working very hard not to have artifacts that have bad provenance. So
yeah.
This is, again, back in the 70s. Anyway, the Met officials brushed off his suspicions and said that we should just be enjoying this vase for the beautiful piece of art that it is and not worry about where it came from or anything like that.
Right.
And obviously that's not the right way to look at artifacts. You need to know more about them than just the fact that they're beautiful and where they came from. And he kept pushing, and eventually Italian officials got involved, and they managed to find out that yes, it was a looted artifact from Italy. It had bad provenance.
Right.
And just in case you're wondering whether or not, you know, anything came of it, after three decades,
yeah,
that vase was finally returned to Italy in 2008. No idea why it would have taken 3 decades when the initial suspicions were brought up in the mid 70s, but yeah, 2008. Yeah.
Crazy.
So Dr. Muscarella was really just sounds like a really cool guy. He wasn't afraid of battling his own employer, the Met, his colleagues, other museum officials, everybody. And, you know, he did get like a little bit ostracized for it. His peers, the people he worked for, they weren't always happy with him.
That's bold, especially kind of a dream career for a lot of people, mm-hmm. would be working for an organization like that. And to just get there and, you know, say, you know what? You guys are all stupid, and
your practices are bad.
Yeah, but you know, you can't do anything about it because
yeah.
I'm right. Yeah, because in fact, they tried to fire him 3 times, and he pushed back every time with lawsuits,
yeah.
and they basically. He won the lawsuits.
Yep. They sided with him and he stayed.
And he didn't care about being there and like, haha.
Like, yeah, well, like, I just can't imagine what kind of person would even want to work in that environment.
Right.
He must have felt very strongly about his convictions as far as this went, and he wanted to be there to do better in the future.
That's, when you're working in a place like a museum, you're an archaeologist, you're somebody who's in what's well known as like a passion field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you often don't do this for the money or the fortune and glory
right.
and all that stuff, but You know, so somebody working at a, you know, at a warehouse or something for $12.50 an hour might not, they might see some injustices going on, but it's not like, really peace. Worth it for them to do anything about yeah. it, right? They're not going to fall on their sword because they're not going to hire a lawyer when they get fired for making waves
right.
because it's just not worth it. They can't yeah. afford it.
They can go find another warehouse yeah. job somewhere else that's better. But
this guy is really passionate about what he's doing. He doesn't care if people there hate him.
Yep.
He's got supporters, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
And
yeah.
it's just, it's admirable to see somebody that, you know, whether he was always right or wrong doesn't really matter. It's admirable to see somebody stick to their guns and be like, listen, you guys, and three different times they yeah. tried to fire him and yeah. he's like, nope, 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 nope.
and he never backed down from his position on looted artifacts and things needing to have good provenance. He even wrote a book in 2000 that was focused on looted ancient Near East artifacts. And he cataloged 1,250 suspicious artifacts in museums and collections around the world. So not just at the Met, but yeah. like around the world. So, I mean, it was a big focus for his entire career yeah. to make sure that artifacts that were bad provenance were called out and people yeah. just didn't get away with that.
Indeed.
Yep. Yeah. Well, he died at the age of 91 on November 27th, 2022. So just a couple months ago. And he, I mean, I just think what an amazing guy, right? He left a legacy of pushing back against the system and holding the Met accountable while he was there. And yeah. I think that every institution really needs people like that, because I think it's so easy to get so focused on a goal that you might forget right. how you're getting to that goal. And if you don't have people who are willing to check you, then that's a problem. So good for
absolutely.
Him.
Absolutely. Yeah. yeah. Good for him. And like I said, whether you think you're right or wrong, if you doesn't really matter, stick to your convictions mm-hmm. and, you know, until you do find out that maybe you are wrong, you know, then well, don't stick to that.
Yeah. Don't stick to that. Like, be willing to change. Yeah, obviously.
Be willing to admit that, you know, hey, oh shit. No, you know.
Yeah. Don't be what Graham Hancock says we are, is people unwilling to change.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you have to be able to change if the evidence says to. But
exactly.
Yeah.
And real quick, we are linking to that blog post I wrote. I found the link and I put it in the show notes. And the last comment was from somebody named Aaron 2 months ago. And these, I can't read any of these comments because they're paragraphs and paragraphs of text. but he did disagree with me.
Yeah.
But I would say, you know, I have over almost 300 blog posts in this series. And I kind of stopped writing in that blog.
When it stopped being cool to write blogs.
Well, yeah,
wait, sorry, that was mean. Write a blog if you want to, but
right. But you know, when I started podcasting,
yeah,
I couldn't really do both, and I was covering the same things, and I was like, well, okay, I'm just going to cover this. I have had thoughts almost daily about turning a lot of our podcasts into blog posts. Mm-hmm. So it's a written form of the podcast, not a transcript, but just like, hey, here's what we talked about, like really, really, really expanded show notes, mm-hmm. just to keep this going. But anyway, I've got 14 likes on this post and 29 comments. I don't think there's 29 comments on the entire blog.
Yeah.
Right? Like I don't think, nobody comments on blogs.
Nobody comments
they
on
comment,
blogs.
I got a lot of comments on like Twitter and Facebook where I'd post these things, but nobody like goes to the website and comments. Mm-hmm. But since this stuff isn't being posted anymore and it's clearly searchable, mm-hmm. then, you know, I'm still getting some hits on it. So
one thing I would say about comments and emails and other things that we get is like, the longer the comment or the email, the more likely it is somebody who is on the wrong side of whatever it is that they're disagreeing
with us.
They are. They're like heavily into justifying.
Yeah. And I'm kind of just like skimming back through this. It's very well written. It's good. It's well organized.
Are you giving yourself a little pat on the back? Like 2012 Webby gets a little pat on the back right now.
It's quality stuff here. So it was actually April 30th, 2013.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
So not as long ago as I thought. So.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Anyway, with that, we will take a break and come back and see what the Spanish police found.
Oh.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to episode 201 of the Archaeology Show. And last time in segment one, 20 minutes ago, we were at the Tennessee Welcome Center. Now we are on I-40 West on the eastern end of Oklahoma at the Oklahoma Welcome Center.
Yeah. And this is the same day.
Same day.
Just a lot of driving in between.
A lot of driving in between. Yeah. It, to be honest, Tennessee was like 4 minutes of driving.
Yeah.
And then we crossed all of Arkansas and then just 20 miles back crossed into Oklahoma. So.
Yeah. Yep. So welcome to our road trip. You're with us.
There you go. And we're not doing this because we're carting around a whole bunch of looted artifacts and planning on selling them.
Oh, no.
Definitely not.
So. You might do that if you were, but of course you'd be crossing state lines and that's a bad idea. You know what? Just don't loot. Just don't loot.
Just don't do it.
Let's just go just don't do that. It. Let's not.
So the Spanish police find hundreds of archaeological artifacts at two homes. An article from The Guardian written by Ashifa Kassam.
Yeah. And this was obviously the second article in a recent time frame that happened to do with looting. So I was like, okay, that's weird. But all right, let's look at it. So the article itself is like really short. There's not a whole lot of meat there. There's just a couple paragraphs. It's more like a announcement of police activity in this area, right? So, but what I thought was really interesting about it is that there's different ways to loot artifacts, and there's also different ways to get in trouble for looted artifacts. And in this case, it's inheritance that is playing part of a role here. So let me explain. When a family member passes away and leaves artifacts to an individual or an organization, there's still a responsibility for the inheritor to verify the provenance. And you and I had a spirited discussion about this and like how far that responsibility goes. What are you doing with the things? Blah, blah, blah. So there is like a lot of gray area here, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you have a family member that you know was, say, an art or antiquities collector, like they did this kind of thing, then if you inherit a bunch of stuff from them, you're probably going to want to make sure that the stuff you got was kind of on the up and up, was legit, right? Maybe even just for your own insurance sake, you're going to have this stuff evaluated if you're going to have it in your home. And to do that, you're going to have it appraised. And once you have it appraised, if the person doing that is a reputable appraiser, they're going to want to know what the provenance is because that affects its value, right? And if you find out that, you know, you got something from mom got it from grandma, and grandma bought it off the street, which happened to be stolen from another family, and it's been missing and cataloged as missing for the last 100 years. Well, you might have an issue on your hands.
You could get in trouble with.
I don't know what the statute of limitations on goods taken from like a family, because that family needs to prove the provenance as well.
Yeah.
Like 100 years ago,
it's
right?
Like two sides of it.
Like, what is the statute of limitations on something that was taken from there? Like, if somebody goes and steals the Mona Lisa out of the Louvre, I don't think there's a statute of limitations on that. I think that in 200 years, the Louvre gets that back if you stole it today.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But if it's stolen from a family,
I don't know. I think it's going to depend on where you're at, who the people are, the region. Like, there's just so many factors that are going to go into dealing with something like that.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what exactly happened in this situation. The story begins when authorities in Spain were tipped off about a home in the province of Alicante containing ancient human skeletal remains. So, of course, they had to go verify when they got a tip like that. And the raid turned up bone fragments that a local archaeologist determined to be between 4,000 and 5,000 years old.
Right.
So, ancient remains indeed. There was no documentation for the bones, so they were deemed to be illegal, basically.
Yeah, just a quick thing here, just a pause. Like, if you get a piece of art from grandma or something like that, that's fine.
That's cool.
Just like put it up.
Yeah, you know, put it up, whatever.
You don't have to go nuts about it. But if she gives you a skull and a whole bunch, like a box of bones.
Yeah, like you need to be worried immediately and probably contact somebody to help you figure out what to do with those.
Like, where's grandpa? Second, where does all this go?
Yeah, be concerned immediately. Because I'll tell you what, telling the difference between modern bones, and by modern, I mean anytime in the last like 20, 30, 50 years. Yeah. And ancient bones is an expert needs to do that because right. You're not going to be able to look at those bones and be able to tell when they're from.
Yeah, unless they're fossilized, they're going to look identical.
Yeah.
We haven't changed at all in 5,000 years.
No, but there are ways for people to tell and you need an expert to do that. Right. So anyway, so this guy who had these bones with no documentation, I get the impression that he was trying to save his own skin a little bit and he collaborated with the police and he sent them to another home.
No, wait. The way that went was, wait, you've got bones. Wait, he's got a lot more than I do. Yeah,
you should go see this guy.
You think I've got a lot.
Yeah, the age-old turn on your buddy to save yourself. So anyway, he sent him to another home that was supposed to have more stuff and it did. There was a much larger collection of 350 artifacts that ranged from Bronze Age mills to parts of a Roman loom and Phoenician amphorae. And also, in addition to those larger pieces, there was nearly 200 bone fragments. And again, there's no documentation for any of those items in this home. When the inhabitant of the home was questioned, he told the police that he had inherited all of these objects after the death of a relative. So that's where this whole inheritance thing comes into the story.
I'm going to use that for pretty much everything. Like, where did all these, not that I have this, but if the circumstance ever comes up, where did all this cocaine come from? I inherited this from my, uncle.
Yeah, it seems like a really flimsy argument. And in this case, I think that there might be some lying involved. I'm not sure that this person is completely innocent of knowing.
There might be.
Yeah. I mean, I saw pictures from the home and there's like these items are on display and they have little labels in front of them of what they are. So I guess unless that's from the police, but it looked like it was like taken in the home of the person. So
it's hard to say.
It is hard to say. But either way, I find it really hard to believe that the person who inherited these items, I definitely believe he inherited them, but I find it hard to believe that he didn't know anything about the looting that was taking place in order to obtain these artifacts.
Right.
The police found several notebooks containing handwritten notes believed to have been written by the deceased relative, documenting the exact location where the items were found. Well, that's cool. You get a little bit of context of where the artifacts were found, so maybe experts can piece together what they are, where they came from, and maybe even figure out a value of them, which I think is helpful for purposes of prosecution if they decide to go that route.
Right.
So anyway, the moral of this story is beware the inheritance of ancient items. And we are talking specifically to you, arrowhead hunters and metal detectorists. Yes. I know you're listening.
Now, there are some rules or laws, I guess I should say, that do protect you, depending on what country you live in. But if we're talking about the United States, you definitely can pick stuff up that you find metal detecting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some metal detectorists, they just like to find stuff. I'm pretty sure I saw an article not too long ago about a guy who found what was clearly like a diamond wedding ring on a beach somewhere in Florida, I think, like in the last month or so. And he put it on Facebook and actually tracked down the owner.
Yeah, which is really awesome. And I think that is super great.
Yeah.
And not everything that somebody who's metal detecting finds is considered an ancient artifact that would be looting. But if you're in a known archaeological site, then that's where you need to be careful because there's a lot of them along the water edges where a lot of metal detecting happens. But so, okay, this really got like my brain thinking about different scenarios, how inheritance can play into looting, if at all, right? So I have some hypothetical examples and I'll read them to you and you can give me your opinion and we'll just kind of go from there.
Okay.
Let's say you have a ranch containing Grandpa's arrowhead collection. It's also found to have a human skull in that collection after he passes away. The ranch has been passed down to grandchildren who didn't even know about any of it, really, and definitely not about the skull. But they don't do anything about it. They just move into the ranch and nothing happens until local authorities are tipped off about the fact that they have a skull in their arrowhead collection.
So I don't think anything's going to happen because if you're talking about Grandpa's ranch in Montana, the local authorities also have arrowheads and skulls on their mantles. Right. So because they grew up that way.
So the Old Boys Network is going to protect them is what you're saying.
Right. But no, seriously, though, if you've got something like that, I would just say when it comes to artifacts, and when I say artifacts, I mean non-human remains artifacts, because human remains are also artifacts if they're ancient, if we're speaking strictly about them. But artifacts that are non-human remains, and they were found on your property. I mean,
you own them.
Ethically, they belong to the native people who mm-hmm. were historically part of that property, who are probably still living in the area. Legally, they belong to you,
mm-hmm.
right? So unless there's something special in your area, your county, your state, but generally in the United States, if it's on your property, they belong to you.
Mm-hmm.
If you're the owner of the Yellowstone Ranch and you have hundreds of thousands of acres or hundreds of acres, I don't know how much they have, but it's a lot,
mm-hmm.
then anything you find there is technically yours. You want to be a good steward of the land and a good friend of the people, though, you might try to return some stuff to the local Native Americans
yeah.
that, you know, have lived there for well before your family lived there.
Mm-hmm.
So, but if you've got human remains, it's not really legal or ethical to keep that in any way, shape, or form, regardless right. of who said it is. You know,
yeah.
I mean, even if the Native Americans in the area were like, yeah, I don't know, it's not my grandpa, mm-hmm. you can have it. You probably still shouldn't, like, have it.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter that you inherited it. You still have that in your possession.
Yeah.
And therefore, you have the responsibility to do something about that
yeah.
and alert the appropriate authorities or whatever. And the reason I did throw in the skull on purpose in this example, because I do know that, like, if you find a projectile point on your own property, then yeah, it does belong to you. It might not be the best way to handle that, because you could have a really significant site below the surface that you might want to,
yeah.
you know, bring in experts on. But it happens, and it's not illegal. So,
but like we said, while they are artifacts, human remains don't necessarily fall in that same category. It's not necessarily legal for you to have those of any age.
No, and you don't yeah. know that they're ancient. Even right. if you find it in a cave or something, it still might not be ancient.
Yeah.
I watch enough true crime to know that people will do a lot of crazy stuff to a body they're trying to dispose of. So,
yeah, and if they're not ancient, I mean, there's no statute of limitations on murder.
Yeah, so basically, be very careful about bones. And also, if it's human or not, it's not always obvious, too.
Yeah.
So, like, it's just better to err on the side of caution when it comes to bone fragments in your grandpa's inherited collection.
Right.
Okay, so next hypothetical example I have is Mama Metal Detectorist pass away, and her children find a bunch of quote-unquote cool shit in her house. They don't know where it came from, but they put it on display in their own homes. And at some point, there's a tip-off and authorities are alerted to them having things in their home.
Right. So, again, if it's not human remains, I probably just would be like, yeah, I got this from my mom. And more than likely, authorities are never going to be tipped off unless it's a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you get some shady neighbor or friend that's like, what is going on with this stuff? And because, I mean, if it wasn't yours and you inherited it from your mom, you probably don't have a lot. But even if you do have a lot and you've got them displayed in, like, shadow boxes and cases because mm-hmm. she had them that way, or you're, you know, somebody did, then yeah, somebody may say something and somebody mm-hmm. might be like, some uppity archaeologist friend of yours might be like, hey, you know, I'm going to tell the BLM or somebody, you know, depending on who they're talking to.
Yeah, because it really depends on the property again. Like, if she lived in an apartment and couldn't
yeah.
possibly own the land that she found the things on, then you're getting into grayer area.
But also, if it's not something that you're passionate about directly
mm-hmm.
and you really don't care about it, like it's not sentimental to you because your mom collected it,
mm-hmm.
you have other stuff from her, then maybe, like, look for a local cultural resource management firm. You can try that. Look under the words environmental, archaeological, mm-hmm. or cultural,
mm-hmm.
and you can see if there is one around there, and maybe they can take a look at it for you. They may not, because, you know, they're paid to do work and you're probably not going to pay them.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if you have a university in town with an archaeology department or an anthropology department, they may not call it archaeology, then call them up. Don't bring all your stuff there.
Yeah.
Call them up and say, hey, I inherited this collection. Can someone come check it out for me? Don't say you want to value it,
because
yeah. they won't do that.
No.
But come tell me a little bit about it.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's something you don't care about and they're pretty excited and they can use it as, like, a teaching collection or something like that, then go there. And then I would say also, and your routes of this, I'm not putting these in any sort of precedence.
No.
Right? There's no order for these. These are just your various
just
routes
options
that you could do. Your other option is if you live near you also live near where the collection came from. Like, if you mm-hmm. live in Montana and your collection came from Oklahoma, don't call your local Native American tribe.
No.
Because you have Cherokee artifacts.
Yeah.
you
yeah.
don't have, you know, local Paiute artifacts
right.
or something like that, or Shoshone or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't have those. But if you live in the local area where those were inherited from, then I would say try to contact your local tribal office
mm-hmm.
if there is one available
mm-hmm.
and, you know, see if they're see if they're interested in repatriation.
And the other side of the artifact collecting too is that it might not be Native American. It could be historical objects too.
It could be bottles.
Yeah. Oh yeah, bottles are a big one. People don't think about looting bottles, but it is looting technically. So in that case, I think talking to your local historical society or even like local museum, if you've got something that's history, and especially people that are really focused on the local area, those are the type of people who would be interested in helping you figure out what you have and if it's okay to have what you do.
And trust me, the legalities behind bottles and stuff are way less stringent because nobody honestly really cares unless they were really stolen from a particular collection. But chances are, I mean, I hate to say this, but chances are you more than likely can just sell those if you don't want them.
A lot of places will buy them. It's
antique stores might take them.
Yeah, if it was found on public land, you have to be very careful about that. But it's almost impossible to prove that.
Yeah.
So I would say be a good person, but, you know, don't worry yourself too much about that kind of stuff.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to go to the next segment and our next location. And I am not going to worry myself about those things, but I'm going to worry myself about these people coming into the rest area the wrong direction.
I know. They keep circling us. Why are they circling us? Yeah, that's super weird.
I don't know what's going on.
Well, we'll see you for segment three. Maybe.
Strange things are afoot at the Oklahoma Welcome Center. All right. Back in a minute or 3 hours. See ya. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 201. And, you know, we just left you. You heard Shoop Shoop. If there's no ads, if you did hear ads, great. That means we're making a little bit of cheddar so we can keep this thing going. But otherwise, we just drove another couple hundred miles from the last segment recording. And we're now at a Cracker Barrel parking lot outside Oklahoma City.
Yep.
Which, if you didn't know, Cracker Barrel is kind of the staple of like overnight parking.
It's like our favorite place because you can get a, you know, reasonable meal, definitely reasonably priced. It's always so cheap, and they have nice big parking lots. They welcome overnighters. It's kind of great.
It's free parking. Yep. So, and if you want a Snickers bar that's 2 feet long, you can get it.
Oh my God! You need a new shirt? Go for it.
Yeah. Some new cast iron. They've got it all. So, needless to say, this episode is not sponsored by Cracker Barrel. But if Cracker Barrel is listening, we will gladly take your sponsorship.
Oh my God, totally. That would be amazing. Yeah. We do stay here a lot.
That's right. Okay, so let's talk about wartime looting.
So the third article that we're talking about is called U.S. Returns Artifacts Taken from Iraq Museum in 2003 Invasion. And as you can guess, this article is primarily about wartime looting and not just the looting that happened 20 years ago, but the sort of long-term repercussions of that looting, which is what we're seeing in this article today.
Yeah.
So, and if you're not familiar with wartime looting, it is another form of looting that happens, again, not exactly under the cover of darkness, like with guys in shovels sneaking up to a monument and digging things up. It's
guys with M16s.
Yeah, exactly. Like, depending on how long ago, it was probably like a tank that rolled in and took things. And that is what happened in Iraq in 2003. Another famous example of this, of course, is the Nazis looting artwork and artifacts from both individuals and Jewish families and also from institutions that they had taken control of. So,
yeah. I got to say that in that scenario, now I was in the military, but I was never in some sort of like combat situation like that.
Mm-hmm.
I was on a carrier. And if combat hits the carrier, you know that it's really hitting the fan at that point. Like combat just doesn't get that far.
Right.
But thinking about the people that were doing this, and the people that took these things, especially back in 2003 or any wartime conflict, man, from their perspective and the things they're being told from on high, they are being told that this is an evil, nasty regime. We need to take them out. All the people suck. Shoot everybody. And everything is going down. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're being told. Right. And they think that. So they go in. Things get destroyed. They walk in. They see something that maybe either could be of value. Or maybe they just think it's cool. And they're like, well, I mean, it's going to just get firebombed. Why don't I take it?
Yeah.
You know, so calling it looting is a little bit, it's kind of like the spoils of war to me a little bit. But it should be returned if relationships are, you know, reestablished later on, which is what happened here.
Yeah. And I think there's looting from both sides, too. Like in the case of the National Museum in Baghdad, I think most of the looting actually happened by inhabitants of the city, people that were just living there, not necessarily the foreign soldiers that came in. Although I'm not saying they didn't do that. I don't think there's any evidence that they did, but it could have happened.
I mean, that happens anytime you have like a natural disaster, anytime you see flooding or anything.
Yeah.
Somebody's looting a Best Buy.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, it is different though, because like in World War II, for example, it was the Nazis that were doing the looting. The people that were doing the invading were also doing the looting. But in this case, it's the people who live there. And they might have just been like, okay, I don't know where I'm getting breakfast tomorrow, but if I take this little cylindrical seal, maybe I can, you know, sell it to somebody and get breakfast for my whole family or whatever. So there's a part of me that kind of understands it a little bit from that perspective. And just on another quick note, when I was looking up, you know, the kind of looting that happens during war, the Monuments Men came up again, which was a movie that came out about 10 years ago, I think, with George Clooney and Matt Damon. And it was all about this famous group that was tasked during World War II to save and protect the artistic and cultural treasures of the various places that they're working in.
Right.
And that was such a great movie. So it makes me want to like watch it and review it on the podcast. Maybe someday we'll get to it. But so back to the National Museum in Baghdad. Of course, this was looted in 2003. The American troops led that invasion and they failed to secure what was second on the list after the Central Bank of important places to protect in Baghdad. So they had a list of things to be protected. They had experts come in and say, you know, this is why this place is super important and needs to be protected. And the National Museum was number two on that list after going through all of the things that should be protected, right?
So they weren't there to destroy the culture.
No,
they were there to they were there to take the regime out of power.
Exactly. Yeah, they did not want destruction to happen to this museum. But whatever happened during battle, blah blah blah, they weren't able to secure it. It was unsecured for 48 hours, and that's when the majority of the looting happened. Now, fortunately, the museum and the employees of the museum, they hid over 8,000 artifacts in anticipation of something like this.
Right.
And I don't know if it was about this invasion specifically or just because there's so much unrest in Baghdad overall in that time period, but there's a lot of stuff that was hidden that wasn't looted. So that was great. And I mean, they really like preserved cultural heritage in Iraq by saving this stuff. It could have been like a huge catastrophe if they had lost all of these really important artifacts. So not actually all that many things were missing by the end of it, but among the missing pieces were thousands of tiny cylinder seals. And the reason this article was written is because on December 14th, 2022, six of these looted seals were returned to Iraq. There was a big ceremony and
just six.
Yeah. Just six of them. Yeah.
Do you know what cylinder seal is?
I do not.
So, you know, like when you see a seal on a letter from like some Robin Hood style movie.
Oh, yeah.
And they've just got like wax and they put their round seal. Well, cylinder seals were the same thing, except it's in a cylinder.
Okay.
So you like roll it out.
Oh, duh. Totally. Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Think of the movie National Treasure.
Oh, do we have
one of the first clues was the pipe that they found in the ship up in the Arctic.
Right.
And he basically cut himself, put blood around the stem of the pipe, and then rolled it out, and it like spelled something.
Yeah.
That's a little more cryptic, but a cylinder seal is kind of along the same lines.
Right. So these six seals that they returned were a follow-up to a larger artifact return of around 17,000 objects that happened in August of 2021. So I guess they're just kind of like still reeling in the stragglers, but that was the big return. And of those 17,000, more than 5,000 of those items that were sent back reportedly came from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York.
I wonder how they got their hands
on
that stuff.
Great. And and this brings me to the thing that was the most interesting to me while I was reading this series of articles, is that among the returned artifacts was also a tablet from the Epic of Gilgamesh that was owned by Hobby Lobby.
Nice.
Now you might be asking yourself, Hobby Lobby, why is Hobby Lobby involved in acquiring antiquities?
Yes.
Well, it's because they have this thing called the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. And I honestly didn't really look up what it is. I can tell by the title or the name of it, it's some kind of museum to prove that the Bible is real, I'm sure.
The Hobby Lobby founder or CEO, I don't know really which one, the high up person in Hobby Lobby is a like far right conservative Christian.
Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, but when you're running a big business like that, you got a lot of power and influence.
Yeah.
And he uses it.
I'm guessing it's Steve Green, who I have in my notes here as the president of Hobby Lobby. And he was behind the arm of Hobby Lobby that mm-hmm. that purchased the tablet in 2014 for $1.67 million. And it was, of course, for this museum that they have in Washington, D.C. Now, in 2019, it was seized from Hobby Lobby because officials believed it was looted from Iraq. This, by the way, is not necessarily related to the museum. We've kind of wandered away from the museum looting itself because it led to this bigger concept of Hobby Lobby stealing artifacts from Iraq. And I just, like, couldn't stop reading about it. This is not the first time that Hobby Lobby and the Museum of the Bible are accused of having and transporting illegal artifacts. In 2011, several shipments of stolen artifacts were seized from their holdings. And then in 2017, they were fined $3 million and since then have been forced to return thousands of objects to Iraq and Egypt.
$3 million.
Yeah.
That is a lot of wooden crosses.
Right. Oh my gosh. It's just ridiculous. And Steve Green, the president, the only quote I saw from him is, it's just gross. He says, in a statement in 2020, he says, he trusted the wrong people to guide me and unwittingly dealt with unscrupulous dealers.
Unwittingly, huh?
I didn't ask
any questions.
No, I know. I'm just like, I call total bullshit on that personally. It starts at the top, you know, and shit rolls downhill. And I just think this guy is just the grossest of gross. His religious beliefs aside, obviously, we don't agree with them, but that's fine. But when you're going to do this, it's about that having the goal of doing something and just not caring how you get to it, having no care for the people that these artifacts were stolen from and the culture, and just solely focusing on building this museum to display the artifacts for their purposes. And I just think it's so gross.
Indeed.
Yeah. So back to the wartime looting. Not all of it happens because of one instance like the National Museum in Baghdad. It's sort of like it grows over time in an area with a lot of unrest. And also people kind of just like, if they don't have an exposure to cultural history, they just don't necessarily care, you know?
Well, yeah. And also, I mean, looting happens for one reason and one reason only, usually, unless somebody's got some weird quest to, I don't know, destroy somebody else's culture. But that rarely happens,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's not like that.
Usually it's perceived value.
Yeah.
So if somebody can see a value in something, whether that is a value to their ideals and proving their ideals so they can put it in their own Museum of the Bible and prove their own thing, or whether it has actual monetary value, which is why you see in places with lots of things that people in the rest of the world want, there are places in the world where, you know, culturally there are things that people want there. You know, I think of like moche masks and stuff like that from from South America.
Yeah.
Well, the people down there, they almost don't care about it, right?
It's
they just
true.
Need to put food on their table for their family.
Yeah.
So they will find these things. They'll steal them. They'll loot them. They'll dig them up. They'll do whatever they can and sell them on the open market because they're making a living doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You almost can't fault them for it because it's kind of their culture.
It's their culture and it's their survival, right? Like they need to feed their families. And if looting is the only way they can figure out to do it, it does make it really hard to fault them for it, for sure. And with Iraq specifically, like there's a whole generation of Iraqis that because of the like restrictive regime that they grew up underneath, they haven't had any access to the like network of museums across the country. They're not learning about their own cultural history. And as a result, they're not going into archaeology, partly because it's controversial and it's just too hard. They don't know a lot about it. They don't care. So there's sort of like a dip in the interest in cultural history, archaeology, all those kind of things because of the unrest across the nation for the last 20 years.
If you're interested in like current work that's going on over there, flip on over to the Archaeotech podcast because my co-host Paul Zimmerman, who's been on this show, has done several field seasons in the last 2 years over in Iraq. And he's worked at Ur, which is a really famous site over there. And he's worked in Lagash. The site is called Lagash.
Yeah.
And all of that is like right in Iraq. And he's like the people he works with, the security forces they have, everybody is just great. They're very interested in the archaeology, interested in the culture. But like you said, there isn't enough of this. Like they're interested because people are out there doing it in their backyard, right? But there isn't enough of this culture like remaining, like they need to get more of these things back there so people can, you know, have the opportunity to see it for themselves.
You just need to foster the desire to learn in the upcoming generations, you know? And I'm sure it's better now because I know it's better as a whole now in the country than it was 20 years ago when the museum was raided. But I just hope that that continues on so that it's starting to change. And I will say that the article that I was reading that I pulled a lot of this from was written in 2013 because it was a 10-year look back on the National Museum. And I couldn't really find any recent reporting about it. So I think it would be interesting to know how that is going for them today, too. So
Yeah, I mean, the whole kind of the point of this network and this show really are to teach you about the cultural history of various cultures, various peoples, around the world, let alone your own. Mm-hmm. We cover a lot in the United States. 75% of our listenership is in the United States. So we cover a lot of stuff here, but it's in the hopes that, hey, if you're out about and you see something or you pick something up at an antique show or a garage sale, you might think twice about what you're looking at. Yeah. You might think about what you have and you might start asking really important questions that are not based on selfishness or greed.
Yeah, I think that is really well put because there's so many reasons why artifacts get looted. And honestly, like we just said, some of them are kind of good reasons because people need to feed their families, but you don't have to participate in that network. And if even down to the smallest person going to an antique store and buying a bottle, if we all just stop doing that, then the demand falls away and people stop doing it.
Listen, if you want to have fun with an artifact or object that you're not sure was looted or not, maybe you inherited it or something like that, just go on Antiques Roadshow. At least go out on TV. You know, you can show it and say, hey, I don't know what this, you know, my grandpa showed it to me. I think he stole it in World War II. I don't know. So just have it be a fun story.
No, it's so hard. There's such a fine line. It's really because you never want to like make somebody feel bad about a beautiful antique that they have in their family, because obviously so many people have that and I don't want them to feel bad about that or go down a rabbit hole of trying to figure out where it came from, because maybe somewhere along the line somebody stole it from somebody. But it is something that you do have to think about, and if there's any reason to be suspicious, that's when you should start looking into it more. So
it is interesting too, though. Just one final thing before we close out. I was just kind of thinking about historical things and paperwork and documentation and stuff like that. And I recently did an episode on this show. If you're a longtime listener, then you heard it a few episodes ago, but I called it the Archaeology of the APN. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember if I mentioned what actually kicked off this whole thing. I started a podcast. I did it for about a year where it was just me reading my curated Google news stories. It's kind of like I've come full circle because it's exactly what I'm doing now.
But we're talking about it rather than just reading.
Well, yeah, it was literally me reading it, and it was about CRM archaeology. So I had a search going and I would literally just read whatever was in the news that week because I felt like it was important for people to be aware of that stuff, you know, around the country. You know, the thing is, I've basically erased that from history. Like, it's not on the APN website anymore. That podcast is not on Apple Podcasts. It's not on Spotify.
Oh, really? It's not?
You can't find it anywhere. The episodes exist on my hard drive in Dropbox, right? So I completely took it off because it wasn't what I wanted. It was what kicked me off into podcasting. But really, that is the beginning of my podcast journey, the CRM Arc podcast, and therefore the APN as a whole. Mm-hmm. And yet, if we're still talking about the APN in 50 years, that the beginning provenance, if you will, of the APN will be forever lost to history because it's gone. I took it away.
Yeah. And it was your prerogative to do that, though, because it is your quote unquote artifact.
But my point is that I feel like we can never truly know the provenance. I mean, unless you've got an eyewitness account of Van Gogh actually painting that painting, you know, or, you know, whoever doing what, then it really is just you're kind of taking it on people's words that that's what happened, you know, and in discovering the true provenance of something might not be possible. Yeah,
it's really hard.
Anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's been probably the longest day we've had in the RV yet of driving. We usually do shorter days and we've got another one teed up right behind it. So we're trying to make our way across the country and we're going to get on that tomorrow.
Yep.
So, all right. Well, thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
Bye.
Hey, Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster and Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.